John 9, 1 through 41. As Jesus walked along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's work might be revealed in him. We must work the works of the one who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva and spread the mud on the man's eyes, saying to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. Then he went and washed, and he came back, able to see. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar began to ask, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some were saying, "It is he." Others were saying, "No, but it's someone like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." But they kept asking him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud, spread it on my eyes, and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' Then I went, and I washed, and I received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now, it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also began to ask him how he had received his sight. He said to them, "He put mud on my eyes, then I washed, and now I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not observe the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner perform such signs?" And they were divided. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him? It was your eyes he opened?" He said, "He is a prophet." The Pharisees did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who was born blind? Then how does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that he is our son and that he was born blind, but we do not know how it is that he now sees, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the ones in charge, for they had already agreed that anyone who confessed Jesus to be the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He's of age. Ask him." So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind, and they said to him, "Give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner." He answered, "I do not know whether he is a sinner. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become disciples?" Then they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses. But as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "Here is an astonishing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but God does listen to the one who worships them and obeys their will. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born entirely in sins, and you are trying to teach us?" And they drove him out. Jesus heard that they had driven him out, and when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir? Tell me, so that I may believe in him." Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and the one speaking with you is he." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Jesus said, "I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see, and those who do see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard this and said to him, "Surely we are not blind, are we?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would not have sin. But now that you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." The word of the Lord.
Good morning, friends. Kelly, thanks for welcoming us into service this morning. And Alicia, thank you for leading us in prayer. Amy, thanks for stepping in. You guys don't know this, but she's filling in last minute because the song leader, Rebecca Ewing, was sick today. So thank you for jumping in, like Kristen did last week during communion. And Jen, what a great reading. Well done. Thank you for that. You made those 41 verses in a row bearable for us. In fact, when you were reading, this isn't part of the sermon, but when you were reading, I remembered this old apocryphal story about the blind man from John 9 encountering Bartimaeus from Mark 10, who also had his eyes healed, his sight restored. And in the story, as it goes, the two of them were chatting and laughing and so glad that they could see and talking about what the sun and the moon look like and all that stuff. And then the guy from John 9 says to Bartimaeus, "And wasn't it weird when he spit on the ground and put mud on your eyes?" And Bartimaeus said, "What are you talking about? He just told me, see, and I saw." And the guy from John 9 says, "Wait, wait. He didn't spit on you? He didn't put mud in your face?" It's a wonderful story. There's more to it. Maybe I'll share it another time. But and before I start, I am supposed to say this, a cookie announcement for you. If you ordered Girl Scout cookies from Sophia, she has them today and they're ready for you. So grab her out in the foyer before you take off. So there we go. Okay, John 9. The Pharisees answered the man, "You were born entirely in your sins." And they drove him out. Here is something that seems so obvious, it hardly is worth mentioning. But, of course, I'm going to go ahead and mention it anyway. A couple weeks ago, during our family lifetime, if you remember, Bill Hunt came forward. And he offered us some extraordinarily good news. His doctors, he reported, had recently informed him that the tumors they had been monitoring were currently undetectable. And although they were not able to tell him what this means long term, what they were able to say was, "Bill, go and live your life." And hearing Bill share that news, after praying alongside him and Julie, after hearing him share his journey with cancer almost a year ago now in our 9:30 hour, if you remember, and of course, after loving the Hunts as we have for more than a quarter century here at East County, when we heard him share that news, we couldn't help ourselves. We rose spontaneously and we applauded and we rejoiced and we cried and we laughed and we showered him with love. And of course, why wouldn't we? Because honestly, what else do you do in a moment like that, right? Just over a decade ago, on an evening, midweek, a group of East County members gathered right here in this auditorium. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, it was Leland Howell who pulled everyone together, though it might have been others as well. In any case, Many people who are here in this room showed up that night, sat in one big circle facing one another, and spent 2 hours offering affectionate attention, prayers, in solidarity with the Langford family, a family who lived among us as members, who were married among us as a couple, who were sent out from us as missionaries to Uganda, a family we've loved, and a family who had recently learned their youngest child, their infant daughter, Bella, had been diagnosed with a life-threatening illness that would require difficult treatment with an absolutely uncertain outcome. It was a grueling and wonderful and emotional and painful and healing evening together, all in one. And after that moment and all the moments of worry and concern and hope that followed, when we heard from the Langfords and their doctors that Bella was healed and that her treatment had been successful, this congregation erupted in praise and thanksgiving and gratefulness and in joy. We wept and we laughed and we rejoiced at the extraordinary goodness of it all. Because honestly, what else would you do in a moment like that, right? And if I were to ask, does any of what I've just described, our responses, surprise you? The fact that when we heard the news about Bill and about Bella, we rejoiced, that we were filled with gladness and wonder and delight at their good news, I'm guessing you'd say, no, it doesn't surprise me that we responded in that way. Not any more than when, almost 26 years ago to the day, on St. Patrick's Day, 1997, a group of East County men and women, again, many of whom are here in this room, stood alongside of Nancy Higginbotham and prayed over her and anointed her and loved on her and grieved with her and yearned for healing from her chronic pain. So that when, in what Nancy still to this day refers to as a miracle in her life, her doctor said to her, "We can't tell you why, but we can tell you that your fibromyalgia is gone." East County celebrated like it was 1999, if you know what I mean. Because honestly, what else would you do in a moment like that, right? Good news deserves good celebration, and East County offered that. But again, all of that is so abundantly obvious, it's hardly worth mentioning. So why then have I gone ahead and mentioned it anyway? Because of this. John 9, our gospel reading this morning, is filled with, as you just heard, so many delightful details and so much that is worth our while to reflect upon that I'm afraid it's all too easy to miss its central message. And I'm hopeful that by keeping Bill and Bella and Nancy in mind, and in particular our responses to them, that we'll be able to hear the wisdom that is at the heart of this passage. Put differently, I hope that by keeping Bill and Bella and Nancy in mind, we might hear just how mind-bogglingly bizarre this narrative we've just heard from John 9 really is. Let me ask you this. Do you ever tell what you presume is a really interesting and entertaining and amazing story, only to get to the punchline and then have your audience say, "Yeah, and?" As if what you've just shared in itself wasn't enough? Does your audience ever do that to you? As if the story that you found so powerful came across as merely a prelude to them, to something else? Has that ever happened to you? Well, that, I think, is exactly what happens when we read John chapter 9. When commentators reflect on this particular passage, nearly all of them focus on the legalism of the Pharisees, for example, or the clever use of light and darkness, sight and blindness throughout the passage metaphorically, or even the oddness of Jesus, as we mentioned a moment ago, making paste of mud from his own spit, which admittedly is weird and perhaps worth a sermon some other time. Or the commentator suggests the whole passage is merely meant to serve as a sign of Jesus' messiahship. And while none of that is necessarily wrong, it's not. In fact, it's all worth reflecting upon. It does seem to me that none of that actually gets at the most important point, as if the entire punchline has been passed over here. When it comes to our three friends, you can easily imagine how utterly unfathomable it would have been had Bill made his announcement 2 weeks ago and our collective response was simply to look at our watch and wonder when we could leave for lunch. How unimaginable it would have been had we heard that news about Bella and yawned. How unthinkable it would have been had Nancy's doctors offered their report and we simply shrugged. Inconceivable, as the infamous Vicini might say. Our joyful response to their good news is so utterly obvious to us that it doesn't even need mentioning. And yet, it is this very same utterly obvious response that is entirely absent in the story of the man born blind from birth. And that, it seems to me, is the clue to the entire point here. In John's entire narrative, not a single person rejoices when the blind man is healed. Did you notice that as Jen read it? And I find that, frankly, inconceivable. Nobody, not even the man's parents, expresses joy or wonder or gratitude or awe in this moment. Not a single person says to him, "I am so happy for you," or asks, "What is it like to see for the first time? Does the sun hurt your eyes?" No one says, "What would you like to look at first?" In other words, no one in the entire narrative stands and applauds this unbelievably good news. And just to the extent that I cannot imagine Bill sharing his report with us without the exultant ovation that followed, I cannot fathom why nothing of the sort occurs here. The man was blind, and now he sees. His tumors are now undetectable. His illness has been eliminated. His chronic pain is now cured. For the first time in his life, he can smile at someone and see them smile back in return. So where is all the requisite whooping and rejoicing that is supposed to follow a moment like that? Because honestly, what else would you do in a moment just like that, right? Only here's the issue. Have you ever seen that film, Ford versus Ferrari? Remember that one? Matt Damon and Christian Bale? There's a moment in the movie when one of the race car drivers is so far ahead that he could coast to a first place finish if he wanted to. But his team asks him to slow down so that all three Fords could finish the race at the same time, tied for first place. And so he does. And then, because of a technicality of who began furthest back from the beginning, the first place trophy actually goes to somebody else. And the audience is left stunned and silent, because the one who received the award simply did not deserve the reward. And everybody knew it. And I have to say, there's probably nothing that offends our sensibilities as greatly as undeserved merit like that. And that, it seems to me, is exactly what's occurring to the man born blind. Let me see if I can explain. There is no one rejoicing with him for one reason. Because no one believes he deserves his reward. Not his neighbors, not the disciples, and quite possibly not even his parents. So that when the Pharisees speak their cruel words, they are merely voicing what everyone else is thinking. You, they say, are a sinner. In other words, you don't deserve this. And instead of rejoicing with him, they drive him out. You see, the one significant difference between the stories I told about Bill, Bella, and Nancy and the one that John tells about the man blind from birth is this. We do not believe that Bill, Bella, and Nancy deserve to suffer. So that when they received relief from suffering, it affirmed for us our sense of rightness in this world. And therefore, we rejoiced. But it was not so for that man born blind. It was on account of his own sins, they said, that he suffers as he does. Even the disciples said so in verse 1. We don't rejoice in his healing because we don't believe he deserves a trophy in the first place. That should be reserved for the likes of Bill and Bella and Nancy. And lest we chalk all this up to those silly first century folks and their stupid beliefs, let us recall that we often say the very same thing. His homelessness is his own darn fault. Her addiction, it's her responsibility. That gun violence, well, that's their issue. And while I'm not opposed to helping someone or even being helped, I don't want it wasted on those who don't deserve it. And the Pharisees said to him, "You are a sinner." And so they drove him out. And just here, it seems to me, is the whole point of this passage. Although everyone else in this entire scene has asked about this man's sins, suggesting he doesn't really deserve this healing, Jesus is having none of it. His help will not be based on some calculation of who deserves it the most. Instead, he scraps the idea of calculation altogether here. Note that this man has never talked to Jesus once before Jesus embarks on his healing. For Jesus, the question seems not to be who deserves help, as it is for everyone else in this scene, but rather, as his actions so often demonstrate, Jesus' question is really this: which of you is willing to offer help? And that stance changes everything. With Jesus, the point is no longer what another person warrants by their righteousness. In fact, it never was. While you were yet sinners, Christ still died for you. For Jesus, the point is not a question ever about them. His point is a question about us. Will we serve one another with whatever gift we have received, regardless of our opinions about another person's sin? Put differently, will we serve one another with whatever gifts we have received, regardless of our opinions of who does and does not deserve our help? That, it seems to me, is the whole point of John 9. Why does no one rejoice when the man born blind is healed? Because, as Jesus says, all the rest of them are blind too. Blind to the fact that God doesn't give gifts because we deserve them. Which, by the way, is not to say we don't necessarily. It's just to say that's not part of the calculation ever. Rather, God gives gifts so that we might share them freely, profligately, wildly, just as Jesus does. Because just like Bill and Bella and Nancy and the man born blind, Jesus believes that God's manifold grace is for everyone. May we never say anything different. Amen.